Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seppi Holmes.
I'm Taylor Beckett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Magnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroos.
I'm a Zuma Nelson.
I'm Gassidon, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. We're getting closer to that magical 50 podcasts. And of course, let's not forget, we had over 400 shows live on radio many years ago. So we're getting close to 500 shows now, John. Anyway, it's pretty good. We've got another show lined up for you today. We're going to be catching up with a Commonwealth Games medalist from the past. Brian Tink won the bronze medal back in 1982 in Brisbane when Australia hosted the Commonwealth Games then. And we're going to get his views on the games coming up, boxing in general, and what it was like to win a medal at a home Commonwealth Games. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And there's been plenty to talk about lately, John.
There's been a lot of sport going on, hasn't there? We've had, well, you've been up in Malaysia for the Aslan Shah Cup. Fantastic job, by the way. Your commentary was excellent.
Thank you.
And the stream was pretty good, too. I thought the coverage was really good.
Look, I really loved it. And I think it was my eighth year doing it. And I have to say that I thought this was the best competition.
Some really good hockey played, too.
Yeah, it was really, you know, Ireland may have come last and only won the one game, but they gave every single team a tough game. And that's what made the competition so good this time around.
And for all the administrators around the world that think we need to make the game shorter and we need to cut players on the field, this was a classic example of why 11-a-side hockey is the prime part of our game. It was fantastic. And to think that they've just cut 10 minutes off it.
Yeah.
You know, bring back that 10 minutes. I want my 10 minutes back.
Would you rather have the 10 minutes or the bully?
Oh, then we could have them both, Ashley.
No, if you had to choose, which one would you go?
The bully.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd have the bully, definitely.
I'm with you with the bully. I think every sport needs its uniqueness.
Absolutely.
And the bully was unique. But I was talking to an umpire about that, and he goes, guys today just don't know how to do it.
It's funny, because I've heard an umpire say, no, don't bring it back, it's too hard, it's too hard. Mate, it's not hard at all. Bring back the bully. One, two, hockey one, hockey two, hockey three, off you go. But you're right about the players. I don't think that a lot of them want to do it because they can't.
Yeah, they're not that coordinated these days.
Oh,
that'll upset a few people.
I think you're absolutely right, Ashley. Their skills are lacking. They don't know how to do it properly.
Anyway, we're both going to have two topics to talk about. John's already taken us down the path on one that we both feel very passionately about. But I'm going to talk about the situation in cricket at the moment. And I understand that there needs to be a code of conduct and you want to respect the integrity of the game. I understand that, and there are rules there. But I just wonder if the rules that are there are the right rules at the moment, because I want to see, when I go and watch any sport, you want to see a contest between two teams. And you want to see really both teams going at each other, trying to outwit each other, not just with skill, but as we all know, there are mental aspects within the game. For example, you know, John, in a game of hockey, and I've witnessed it pitch side, and there's one comment I can't actually repeat on air that Kieran Gubb has made to Ashley Jackson at the Hockey World League, because there were a few expletives in there, but it was damn funny. But it was put, and Ashley Jackson just had no comeback to it, but it was very, very funny. But banter between fast bowlers and batsmen, that has been there forever and a day. And I just think that now the powers that be are taking away some of that. I mean, we saw Marsh has been fined and had penalty points for reacting to a comment that Rabada made to him after he'd got out. Come on, he just got out, he's disappointed, he's bound to say something if someone said something to you and gave you your marching orders. You're going to react. And I just think that shouldn't be fined. But again, if we're going to have TV cameras in and it's so audible, then they should have to turn it down or whatever, and we should just let things go. But it's like Rabada. To me, he's the most exciting fast bowler there is in world cricket at the moment. And there haven't been any truly world-class bowlers. But if you look at him, he's having a bit of a yap because he can back it up with what he does with the ball. And that's the difference. Now, there's a lot of bowlers will have the yap, but they can't back it up with their actions. And it's the same with batsmen. I mean, Derek Randall used to talk non-stop. Rodney Marsh used to get so annoyed with him, and he used to just tell him to shut the hell up. But if you look at it, McGrath liked to have a yap. Sure, he didn't like it when he got it back, or he got tanked around the park. Mitchell Johnson, again, could back it up. He was another one. Craig McDermott loved a little bit of a spat, would get in a batsman's face. Dennis Lilly and Jeff Thompson. Merv Hughes is another one. Ian Botham. Sir Ian Botham now. Again, I mean, how many send-offs did he give batsmen? I mean, and I just think we're getting too precious with all of this. I mean, you look at the Pakistanis as well. You know, you had Wasim Akram. He loved to do it. Waqar Yunus is another one. And I just think that if you look at that era as well, or a bit before that, some of the players we mentioned there, there were no helmets, or the protective gear was nothing like what it is today. Right. Also, there were unlimited bouncers in those days. And, you know, so the intimidation was on a far greater level than just a few words thrown at a batsman or thrown back at a bowler. And, I mean, I just wonder, there's the famous story, and I can't remember who it was against. It might have been De Viv Richards went to Worcestershire, didn't he? No, he went to Durham, didn't he, after. But anyway, it was Malcolm Marshall was playing against Worcestershire at Grace Road, and that's Leicester, isn't it? But anyway, he's playing at Worcestershire, sorry. Anyway, and he bowled one of his West Indian teammates, and he ran straight past him, high-fived the wicketkeeper, ran all the way to the boundary and opened the gate for him. Now, I just wonder, what would the administrators today do to a bowler that did that? I mean, he hasn't said anything verbally, but he has given him, to me, one of the best send-offs a bowler has ever given a batsman. And he would probably be suspended for two games. And I think with the Rabada thing, look, I understand, as the rules stand at the moment, he's crossed the line, he has to pay the penalty. But I think that the rules are a little bit, I think, a bit soft. And what we're doing is we're actually ruining the spectacle of the game, which is, I want to see the best bowler against the best batsman, and you're depriving us of that. So suddenly my interest in the next test has gone down a little bit because we're not going to see that.
I find your last comment there quite interesting, actually. When you talk about not losing interest in the next game, because to me it's whether that person's in the 11 or not, there's still someone who's going to be there.
Oh, look, there still will be, but it just takes the edge off it. I think it does. I mean,
would it have taken the edge off it if you had done a hamstring?
Yes, it would. Yes, still. Same thing. No, definitely. Okay. I mean, it's like if you had an Australian team when Shane Warne was at his peak and he wasn't playing, you can bet your bottom dollar the other teams would go, whew.
Unless it was India playing Australia in India.
Yeah.
The only time we've ever beaten India in the last 40 years in India was when he didn't go.
Yeah, and Gilchrist was captain.
Yeah, Ricky Ponting didn't go either. So the best bowler and the best batsman of the generation.
One door closes, another opens. I totally agree with what you're saying, but I like to see the best pitting themselves against the best. And to me, that's what it's about. So I will always be disappointed, but as you say, there's often a player that will step up, fill in that gap, and then that is exciting. But going into the game, sure, you're disappointed that the best players aren't.
I always think back to Anderson, the Queensland wicketkeeper, who Ian Botham made stand up to the stumps at the Wacker Ground here one day. Broke his thumb. 3 Shield games left to the season. The young standing wicketkeeper comes in to take Anderson's place. His name was Ian Healy. Played three Sheffield Shield games and went on to play for Australia.
But I'll give you another story, a famous one. If you remember Phil Edmonds, slow left armer for England, was actually sponsored by Swatch.
Didn't his missus, was that?
Frances Edmonds.
She was quite a raconteur of sorts.
She was indeed, and he was not allowed to speak to the media because he said things that were sort of controversial. So then she would say, well, I think if Phil was here, he would say this. So they got around it that way, which was very clever. And I mean, he was an incredibly intelligent man, and in fact, Bob Willis says in his book that he didn't like Phil Edmonds being in the dressing room because he would always come out with these really cutting one-liners. And Bob Willis, although I think is not stupid, he just wasn't on the same intellectual level, and he struggled with Edmonds. And he said, I didn't have him in my teams because I didn't like that side of it. But the game was against New Zealand, and he was sponsored by Swatch, and he used to wear a white Swatch on his wrist. Now, when Phil Edmonds had come into bat, he'd asked Richard Hadley to remove his sweatbands, and as we all know, Richard Hadley wore the white sweatbands because he said it was cutting his hand off from his wrist. Anyway, so he made Hadley take them off. He probably paid the price for it because Hadley wasn't one of those that gave a lot of yap, but he was just did the actions and got rid of him. So when Phil Edmonds was bowling and the New Zealanders were batting. It was Martin Crowe facing, and he went to the umpire and he said, "Excuse me, could you ask him to take his watch off, because it's, you know, putting me off and it's separating his wrist from..." So Phil Edmonds made a big thing of it, and of course it was great for the sponsor. So he takes his watch off, hands it to the umpire and whatever. They took a single the next ball, and Jeremy Coney's then on strike for New Zealand, and he walks down the wicket and he says to the umpire, he says, "Excuse me, could you get him to put his watch back on?" He said, "I find the tick relaxes me."
Oh, that's a great story.
Now, to me, you know, that's part of what cricket is about. And if we're going to sanitise it so much, you're going to lose those magical moments, I think.
Have we seen them step over the line, though, in this last test? Have we seen South Africa, the cricket authorities there, be complicit in
with those
over
masks?
The line?
Yeah. That was disgraceful, in my opinion, yeah. Look, I don't think you can stop. You can stop if you've seen them coming in with them.
You certainly don't parade with them, though.
Yeah, and you certainly don't advocate it, promote it, and say, "Ha ha ha, this is funny." Yeah, I think that was wrong.
Look, you know, we all have pasts, and sometimes your past comes to catch up with you. And as nasty as that situation was in the hallway there between the two players involved, and as probably nasty as the comments may or may not have been, it's got to stay between those guys in a funny way. It's not for us to be going out there and besmirching the character of someone who's not even involved in the contest that we're watching.
But that's where, John, and if you go back to the days when there were issues, a lot worse issues with football, say the racism at crowds, it was always the comfort of the anonymity of being in a crowd that they would shout the racial jibes to the black players, because no one was going to know who they were because they couldn't see it. And of course, you know, Cantona was one who did pick out the man and he did take, you know, revenge on the guy. Now, I'm not condoning that, but it was understandable why he necessarily did. And I think, you know, sometimes, and I've witnessed this at the WACA, where there was a situation, this was a few years back, South Africa were playing Australia, and a South African was waving his flag at the front whenever they, you know, hit a boundary or whatever, he'd stand up and do that. And this Australian walked down the front, blew his nose in the flag. The South African hit him, and the South African got thrown out of the ground. Now you go, well, hang on a sec, the security guy's there to me. I'm not condoning he should have hit the guy, but the guy that blew his nose in the flag, that was pretty upsetting and it was unnecessary. He should have maybe handled it a little bit better, but it was again where I think the security inside the ground let down the situation.
He blew his nose on another country's national flag.
Yeah.
You complete, absolute moron. You deserve to be thrown out and kept out of field. That's just disgraceful. I know someone that worked on a sheep boat that years ago, the sheep boats out of Fremantle Port here, and they were in a Middle Eastern port, and one of the Filipino guys went up the front or back of the boat to pull the flag down at the end of the day or whatever it was, and as he dropped the flag down, he stood on the flag, and he was shot from the wharf in the leg by one of the local security guards, because he saw him step on his own country, on this guy's country's flag. That's how seriously some of these countries take flags. In fact, you could probably end up doing a large deal of time in a very unsavoury prison doing that sort of stuff to flags.
Oh, certainly in some countries it is.
Massive. That stuff I find more repulsive and worse than sledging someone about their mother.
Yeah, but I agree with you. I think the sledging should stay on the pitch and between the two
what
protagonists.
What was it that the famous conversation between Ian Botham and Rodney Marsh? It's probably not very PC in this current climate, but back in the day, Botham comes out to bat and Rod Marsh is standing there behind the wickets, and Rod Marsh says to him, something like, how's your wife? And my kids or something stupid like that. You know, now I don't want to go through it because it's actually, you know, uses some words that aren't very nice these days. But that sort of stuff's brilliant when it's just between a couple of players and they throw it back and forward. You know, one of the greatest bits of sledging probably ever is Steve Waugh and Curtly Ambrose. when Curtly Ambrose is the most fearsome looking bowler probably ever to play the game. If intimidation by a fast bowler is real and true, Curtly Ambrose just has to stand there and he's intimidating. And Steve Waugh looks up at him and goes, what the, are you looking at? That is just classic. Now, that situation is just as bad as two blokes bumping shoulders together. I mean, that's nothing. Bumping shoulders is really nothing.
Yeah, look, I mean, I, as you know, I played a lot of cricket in my younger days, and I remember when I first came over here, it was the only time it ever happened in a game of cricket, playing against Fremantle, and this guy just kept, the bowler just kept running down the wicket and trying to block you when you were taking a single. So it had happened, the umpire did nothing. I'd ask the umpire, are you going to say anything? Because understandably, he's allowed to run through his run and just stop, but he would then, as we were taking a single, move across to try and impede us taking a single or getting...
Well, no, that is walking on the pitch.
Yeah, but it's also just not allowed. Yeah. Anyway, so I reached the point where I thought, okay, if you're going to do it next time, mate, I'm going to take you down. And I did. I just ran straight through him, got the single, and he got up and squared up to me. And then the umpire just ran for the hills. I said, well, he's not allowed to square up to me. And I mean, but the situation was made bad. But again, it just was something that happened on the pitch. No one was hurt. It was part of the game. Psychologically, who came out on top? I'd like to think I did. He may think he did by getting me to react that way.
What I find interesting is, at the moment, with what's happening in South Africa, the crowds are terrible. They are terrible, terrible crowds. When we consider that this is two of the heavyweights of world cricket playing, and that, you know, South Africans always tell us how much they love cricket and how good they are at it, and they're not turning out to support their team at all. You've got a situation where one of the umpires is standing out in the middle of the ground and gets so frustrated with what's happening in the crowd that he can't concentrate on his job anymore. So he asks these people to be removed so he can do his job. And the match referee comes down and says, oh, no, no, bring him back in there. Got to get him back in there. Why would that step be taken by Mr. Crowe? I can only think because he's had the authorities say to him, or the broadcasters, probably both, say to him, no, we need them there, because if you take them away, there's no atmosphere here whatsoever, because there's no one here. And no one can hear anybody wearing a stupid paper mask on their face say anything. Those sorts of issues worry me a whole lot more than players having a go at each other. And also the use of the stump microphone by South African broadcasters, and also the leaking of what should be confidential videotape.
Yeah, the leaking is wrong.
That's terrible stuff, because, I don't know, we've all done stupid things before, and we've all had incidents, and I wonder how we'd feel about it if someone decided that they would just let that video footage be aired.
Well, I've always said that the cameras should not be allowed in the dressing rooms or that area. To me, that is sacrosanct. That's the one place where a player can vent how
he
feels. But
they'll tell you it's in the interests of security.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is that none of all these security cameras we see in our sporting arenas and around our streets, none of them stop you getting punched in the head. It just gives them a better chance of catching the perpetrator. Because some drunk guy who's gonna punch you is gonna do it regardless of whether there's a CCTV camera sitting there. And we saw it, those players knew there's cameras in those corridors.
Yeah, but they would have forgotten it.
Exactly, they do. At the heat of the moment, yeah. Bang. And it's a terrible invasion of privacy.
No, exactly, but look, that's my view. I think we've got a little bit too precious, and if you're listening out there, you may have a difference of opinion. Share it with us on Facebook or in the comments on the website.
But maybe what cricket really does need to move forward in the future, mate, is full body contact. Could be onto something there, those two.
That would be good.
Hi, I'm Derek Underwood, and this is the Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are listening to Not the Footy Show. And time for us to turn our attention to our guest today on this podcast. Now, can you believe he was a 17-year-old when he stepped into the ring at the 1976 Montreal Olympic Games? But he also went to the Commonwealth Games, and of course they're coming up very closely. And he won the bronze medal in Brisbane at the Commonwealth Games in 1982. He's regarded as one of Dubbo's most famous athletes. And he had over 468 amateur fights. Never turned professional, but nearly 500 bouts as an amateur. That's a phenomenal effort. And, of course, the guest we're talking about is Brian Ting.
Brian Tink, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks very much, mate. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Brian, before we talk about your Commonwealth Games experience, it must have been quite a big step up, because I believe you were just 17 years of age when you were selected for the Montreal Olympics and made your debut as an Olympian.
Yes, it was a bit of a shock to the system, coming from a country town like Dubbo. I had had a few fights around Sydney and the biggest towns like Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane and that, and Perth, but Olympic Games is a bit bigger than that.
I bet it was. And how did you find the whole experience?
Well, personally, I think I was a little bit young to go over there. As you said, I was 17. It's a big step up from young kids. Whereas today, I think with the boxers, if they can get more international experience, the amateurs in Australia, those big steps aren't so big.
And I believe that even though that was 1976, you're still Dubbo's only Olympian.
Yes, unfortunately. We had a very good young lady that was a cyclist, Megan Dunn, but she had a few bad falls after she went to the Commonwealth Games, won gold at the Commonwealth Games, and she gave it away before the Olympics, so I'm still the one and only from Dubbo.
How does that feel? That must be pretty special.
Well, it is a very big honour. It's a bit rude after 40-odd years that there hasn't been another athlete from Dubbo inspired to do the hard yards and get there, but all he's hoping.
Well, absolutely. Let's hope that there is another one just around the corner now. Commonwealth Games is obviously not as big as the Olympics, but also you sort of feel today that the Commonwealth Games was, in your day, meant a little bit more than maybe it does today. Do you feel that?
Not really. I know a lot of boxers are still boxing, like young fellows coming up now. They are inspiring to get to the games. They represent, in any sport, if you can represent your country, which the Commonwealth Games does, you're representing Australia. You're not representing your town, your state, or a country, and it's a big call. And I think a lot of athletes still look at it as a very big plus to their career.
No, I'm sure they do. It just seems to have lost some of its sort of sheen over the years, in that, you know, obviously the world has changed a great deal in recent times.
Well, the world's such a small place today. You can be in Dubbo today and Perth in a couple of hours. You know, it's just the way the whole world's changing, I'm afraid.
No, it is indeed. Now, you had two appearances at Commonwealth Games. Your first one was in Edmonton, and then your second was in Brisbane. Was it very different having one, obviously, overseas, and then being fortunate to have a home Commonwealth Games?
Well, I think I enjoyed the home ones better. I've been to bigger events, World Championships at Madison Square Garden, World Championships in Montreal. I picked up a bronze medal there. I picked up a bronze medal in Brisbane, and that sort of means a lot more to you, because you do it in front of your own Australian people, and they're cheering you on, and you're doing your utmost not to let them down.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's not every day that you have a home Commonwealth Games, and is it a little bit more pressure on you being a home Games as well?
That depends on the athlete, I feel. Crowds, I love crowds singing out there, cheering you on. But some people, they get a bit cold on that sort of atmosphere. It helped me, I feel. I love the correct crowd there cheering on. And I was very, very, very pleased to be able to represent in Australia.
What do you remember most about the games in Brisbane?
I probably shouldn't say it, but the big party at the end. No, the whole game itself, the people of Brisbane, and I think the Gold Coast are going to be the same. That didn't matter where you went, if you were at an Australian track season, you were treated like royalty, which athletes love that, honestly. Some of the minor sports that don't do real well at these games, that they still get treated like royalty when they're in your hometown.
No, I mean, and so they should be, because, as you said, it is a huge honour to represent your country, and you are out there representing all of us that couldn't make it.
That's exactly right, and the athletes I feel sorry for is the ones that do just as much hard work as athletes that make it, and they just get pipped at the post. You know, you've got to feel for those athletes. I've been there myself later in my career when I wasn't quite training hard enough and didn't make an Olympic Games I thought I should have. But that was my own fault. I wasn't trained hard enough. I admit that. But some of these other athletes, I feel sorry for.
I mean, boxing is a tough one because you may be the best, and especially in your days or even today, the best amateur, but you could get a decision go against you. And we've seen that at Olympic Games, we've seen it at Commonwealth Games, we've seen it in the qualifying rounds for that sport. And it is one of those frustrating things about the sport.
Well, if it's a sport, you love it, you do it, you're a cop, what happens? You know, I've had decisions go against me in pretty big fights, so dirty on, but what can you do? Just batter on and try and go better next time.
Do you think there is a way that boxing could improve the scoring?
I think the system, I don't like the button, the electronic system, that's out. I think they've gone away finished with that anyway. But they've got to get the younger judges. I think that's half the trouble. A lot of the judges are a bit too old, a bit long in the tooth, and they don't look quite as good as a younger person.
Right, I mean, it is, of course, obviously now that, as you said, the scoring has changed in that it used to be so much about having to throw the punches and be seen all at the same time by the same judges, which was a tough one, and that's why in the Olympics, obviously not Commonwealth Games, the Cubans were so good because they'd move the fighter they were fighting against into a position where they could throw the punches and all the judges could see.
Yes, I fought two Cubans. I didn't find them any different than anybody else to fight, to be quite truthful. You know, if you've got the right attitude, you don't have names. I was the first Australian ever to beat a Russian. I won a gold medal in Jakarta in 79. That was their A grade team. He went on to win a silver medal at the Olympic Games in Moscow. But mate, if you've got the right attitude, they get up in the morning, they put their shoes on the same as you, they do their hair and have a shower the same as you, mate. They've just got to put your mind to it.
There has been a lot of talk lately that we might see boxing drop out of the Olympic Games, which to me as a traditionalist, and boxing's been around since day dot at the Olympics, do you think that would be, apart from being a huge shame, it would be really bad for the sport?
I don't think it will drop out, to be quite honest. It's the biggest competitive sport in the Games. It's on every day of the Games. And I just can't see them knocking it out because, one, as you said, it's been there since day one. And it's the biggest participant in the whole Games. So how would they warrant dropping it out? And they're bringing women into it as well now.
No, and that is good that it has got that equality now. And some people didn't like it, but the women have really shown that they love it.
Well, to be honest, Arthur Tunstall was a very good friend of mine. He didn't want women in boxing. He didn't like women boxing. I don't like women boxing. But if they would choose to do it, who is anyone else to say they can't do it? That's my opinion. It's not compulsory. They do it on a voluntary basis. Good luck to them.
You now, I believe, are still doing some coaching with the PCYC clubs in Dubbo. I mean, do you see talent coming through, or have the numbers dwindled a little bit over the years?
Well, I think the numbers have picked up in Dubbo. I've got two young boys that I think have got a lot of ability. There's a couple of other young kids in the gym got a hell of a lot of ability. And I think boxing in general in this area has picked up. I think there's got to be more emphasis on teaching coaches to coach properly. They don't worry about the fence stuff, which I think is the number one thing in boxing. You've got to be hit and not be hit. That's the name of the game, which the great Johnny Femington wrote in his book. So... And he went fairly well, so I'd say you've got to follow his footsteps. Hit and not be hit.
Absolutely, that's the key thing. Now, I mean, what do you feel that boxing's given you the most in your life?
Well, it's showed me the world. It gives you respect for your opponents and respect for people in general. I feel, unfortunately, a lot of trouble comes on with rugby league players. They play up here, they get drunk and play up. You seldom hear many boxers playing it with alcohol in it. It's a very, very, it's a tight-knit community. They help one another. I've been going to reunions for the last 30-odd years now, and if anyone's down, they help them out. There's never an argument or a fight at these reunions. Up to 500 people at the Hall of Fame in Melbourne there was. And just the respect that boxers give to other people are astronomical.
It is phenomenal when you attend those boxing functions that there seems to be this real brotherhood and a huge amount of respect amongst all of the boxers, even if you may not have fought each other.
That's right. friends through boxing that a lot of them I box with, a lot of them I met after boxing. Well, the professionals, Barry Michael, Jeff Malcolm, Graham Brooks, Lionel Rose, Johnny Femishon, and mate, they're all gentlemen. It's hard to believe, but yeah, that's just the way the sport is.
It is indeed. I mean, how do you think Australia will go at these Commonwealth Games in boxing?
I honestly can't comment on that. I don't know what sort of team we've got, and I don't know how the overseas people are travelling. I've just sort of got back into it after a few years off, and I'll know more next year. I've got a couple of kids training going quite well, and they're about to have their first fights. So I'll know more once I've been following it a bit longer.
Well, Brian, it's been great catching up with you. Thanks very much for your time, and I'm sure that everyone will have listened to your words and will embrace the fact that they're fortunate to participate at a home Commonwealth Games.
I hope they do, because it's one of the greatest feelings you can ever have, Ash. And thanks very much for calling me on, Ashley.
Not upon my pleasure. Thanks very much, Brian.
Right, mate. Catch up.
I'm Azuma Nelson, and you are listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and Azuma Nelson. Well, there's a great story about that, because Brian Tink, when we had the Johnny Famishon dinner, and you know I was emceeing that for the unveiling of the statue, he came up to me before, and he had these photographs of him fighting Azuma Nelson.
Oh, really?
It was the World Team Championships at Madison Square Garden. And he was a lot taller than Azuma, and it was just a 3-round bout, and Azuma knocked him out in the 3rd round, and he goes, you can tell everyone tonight that I'm here, he goes, and that I'm proudly the first Australian that Azuma ever knocked out. Which I think shows what a great sense of humour Brian has. And he gave Azuma one of the pictures, which they both signed, which was fantastic. But what a career he had, and obviously some great memories in the world of boxing. He's still involved in the sport as well.
Gee, getting punched in the head by Azuma. Ouch. You wouldn't be getting up in a hurry, would you?
Well, it was funny. There was Azuma was leaning over him in one of the photographs, and I said, so, Zoom, what were you saying? He said, I was saying, go to sleep.
Speaking of sledges, that's a pretty good one, isn't it? Now, my turn.
Absolutely.
Look, as you know, I do the Reverse Stick podcast with my mate, Matt Allen.
And what a good job you do. I
Thank
enjoy
you
listening
very much.
To it.
Good.
Even when you bag me.
Yeah. I hope you did enjoy the good humour that
was I going. Did indeed.
Yeah, you can listen to podcast 39 to hear us bag Ashley Morrison. No, but look, so I'm a bit reticent to talk about hockey here, because it's about a greater world of sport, this particular podcast, and we talk about hockey a lot.
Hockey is part of the great...
It is. But I can't shy away from this issue, because it's about the primacy of one of the great sporting competitions that exists in this country, domestic sporting competitions, and that's the AHL. It's been going for decades and decades.
I think it's 92 years this year.
92 years. And in the last few years, say 5 years, they've been tinkering with it a little bit. They've done really silly things like invite international teams, and not just full international teams, but underage international teams.
Development teams.
Development. To come and compete in our showcase national domestic competition. Now, the plan is, so I'm being let, they're running trials at the moment, to turn our AHL into a 9-a-side competition. Not only a 9-a-side competition, a 9-a-side competition where there are restrictions placed on the number of players that can be in certain parts of the field at any given time. They're not goals anymore. They're points. We're going to be scoring points in hockey. I think they've got the net in the wrong place if you want to score points. You put it on a pole if you want to score points. When you put a net around a frame on the ground, they're called goals. It is just such an infuriating concept from the very beginning of thinking about it. It is dumb. No one in hockey likes it. It is just mind-boggling that the administrators come up with these band-aid solutions to problems that don't exist. There is nothing wrong with 11-a-side hockey. 11-a-side hockey is fine. What is wrong is that we don't administer it properly, we don't market it properly, and hockey people don't support it properly. One of my biggest bugbears is the hockey family supporting the hockey community, because we don't. We don't support it like other sports support them themselves. The number of people I know that play hockey but never go to a game, never go to an AHL game or an international game, but have memberships to another code that they've never played before in their life and will religiously and regularly go along to that code. I'm staggered by that. When are you going to come to a hockey game? Now, that's a real big problem the hockey community faces, is turning ourselves onto the sport. Forget about the rest of the world. If we can't make hockey people watch it, we've got no chance.
Well, it's funny you say a Band-Aid solution, because it's the only thing I'm allergic to is actually Band-Aids. They make me itch and I come up in a red welt. So that is how I feel this whole idea is. I'm totally allergic to this idea. I think it is bizarre. I mean, now I had to commentate the Hockey India League when we went 2 goals for a field goal and they were called goals. This concept is even worse, because you've got power play goals, you've got field goals worth 2, you've got bonus point goals, you've still got penalty corner goals, you've still got penalty stroke goals. There's just too many different variations. And so the points, as you say, although I think because you've got all those different ways of scoring, it has to be points. But how are you going to differentiate between all of those points and how those points were scored? Are you going to have 6 columns across the top like you have in the sport we don't mention, so that you can say, well, we've had 4 field goals, which were 2 of them were worth 2, but then there were bonus points because they were in the power play goal, so those were worth 4 goals, and then, points. Then we've got the bonus point goal, but then again, one of those was in a power play, so that's another. It's just ridiculous. And whoever came up with this should be kicked up the arse, in my opinion. I think it is the dumbest thing I've ever read in terms of tinkering with rules. The rules of hockey need to be looked at, as we've said many, many times, to be simplified. And we need to educate the public better and make them more aware of what is happening in the game, what these moments of skill entail, and that will then get people more engaged with the game in the long term, rather than what they're trying to come up with now. I mean, I watched one of the trial games. After that, I was like, I'm never watching this again. It is awful.
Oh, it's terrible. There's no midfield.
It is just dreadful. It doesn't... Supposedly, it's meant to be more exciting. Well, there's no flow to it, because it's stop, start, stop. You know, you get a goal scored. Now in international hockey, you know, there's a 40 seconds so they can show the replays on the TV. Players go back. But in this, you know, you're just going to the bonus point goal. So there's just... It's stop, start, stop, start. There's no flow to it. I absolutely hated it. I struggled to watch the whole game, and I vowed I would never watch it again.
Well, I'm not going to. It's absolute joke. It's not indoor hockey. It's not outdoor 11-a-side hockey. It's this horrible, bastardized hybrid in between that has none of the redeeming factors of either of those two forms of the game.
I just, the thing I find unbelievable, John, is, and you know me, I love my history of various sports, and I just think you do not destroy. How many sports would love to have almost 100 years of history?
Oh,
they would die for it.
Exactly.
I mean, the A-League would hang out. If their clubs had 50 years of history, it would make such a difference. You know, the best they've got is the Glory at something like, 28 years this year. You know, but it's not enough history, and we've got, though, nearly 100 years of history. You know, I look at your club, 85 years old this year, Fremantle Hockey Club, but you're destroying that history in one fell swoop, because the minute you hold one of these bastardized competitions, all of that history's been washed away.
Yeah,
it's gone.
That's right.
Because you had 1 year where you did not play 11 aside in the way the tournament was set up to be run.
Where are you going to pick your national teams from? You don't think the Germans and the Dutch and all these other national sides are going to sit back going, yeah, Australia, you've been winning everything for the last 40 years. You go and change your system and play your little nines game. We'll keep playing 11-a-side, and when you clowns turn up at major tournaments, you're not going to have any idea how to play against us, because we're so used to it. You're not going to have the space that you had when you're playing your silly nines tournaments. You're not going to have any of the systems set up to play against 11 players? Great. bring it on.
And your forwards are going to forget to come back and do their jobs defensively.
Yeah, absolutely, because it turns into this two blokes standing at the other end, smacking the ball as hard as they can to two blokes standing at the other end of the field. Or women, as the case may be, but you get what I'm talking about. And the most positive any comment has been, you know, on the social media about this, the most positive comments have been, oh, maybe we should just give it a chance and see what it's like.
Yeah, then have it as a separate competition, not as the Australian Hockey League.
No.
Now, the thing I find funny about this, John, because we're being told that this was a we're told it was a report or a study done by the Australian Sports Commission.
Yes.
Now, I've been trying to get hold of that report or study read it myself. It's very difficult to get. Seems to be hidden in a drawer in Fort Knox, locked behind seven safes or whatever.
Well, it's certainly not up on the website at the website that hosts all of those reports that you can get hold of.
Exactly.
That's interesting.
Exactly. Now, I've contacted the Australian Sports Commission, yet to have a reply as yet. But the interesting thing is, if you go back and you read their report post-Rio, now what they say in that report, which is actually on their website, it says that what hockey must do is increase the talent pool between the age of 20 and 30. Because obviously the disappointment of the performance in Rio. Now, if you go to nine-a-side, and if you read the document that is coming out from Hockey Australia about this nine-a-side, where they're saying there's going to be money for the players, and it's going to save them money at costs and travelling interstate, it's also going to mean that they can bring in overseas players. How are you going to increase your talent pool of 20 to 30-year-olds if you're reducing the number of players on the pitch and you're bringing in foreign players?
That's a very good question, Ashley. I don't know that there's a logical, sound, a reasonable answer to that. In fact, I'm sure there's not a logical, sound, reasonable answer to that.
So the whole concept seems to me to fly in the face of what the Australian Sports Commission was recommending post-Rio.
Oh, the other thing, and all those Luddites out there that think the problem with Australian hockey is that we have the AIS based in Perth and not in the eastern states, is a moron. I'm sorry. Whichever state it gets based in, all of the problems you claim exist because it's based in Perth will exist if wherever it's based. Unless you base it in every city at the same time, do not use this as an excuse to mount arguments to move the AIS to suit your own personal agendas.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that worries me a little bit. If we're seeing the state that appears to be pushing for this nine-a-side is Victoria.
Yeah.
And if you look at the state that is pushing to have the AIS move to their state, although New South Wales has joined in the push as well now by offering the players accommodation, but is Victoria. Now, I think it's Hockey Australia.
Queensland's always had a die on it too.
They have, but Hockey Australia needs to be very careful. If they're going to give so much power to one state, that is very dangerous down the track.
You know why it's in WA?
I'm going to say now.
And why it's worked for WA is because it avoids all of that eastern states rivalry rubbish that goes on that we see in so many other sporting bodies. It happens, you see it in football, soccer, football, certainly happens in rugby and rugby league, happens in all sports. Sydney and Melbourne compete against each other, say, oh, we're the biggest and best and we should have it, and that internal rivalry often is to the detriment of any sport.
Well, it has been to rugby union.
Oh, it's been to a lot, you know, even cricket suffers from it. Basketball suffered from it. You know, and that's why it's been good for hockey to have it here, because it's taken all of those rivalries out of the picture. You all have to just suck it up. It's in Perth.
And then the other thing, John, that you have to look at that, because when it was set up, WA was extremely dominant in terms of the players it was producing for the national teams. Now, there's, as always the case, it ebbs and flows. Currently, it's not quite, there aren't as many, although this year's, this batch of players, there's more WA players than there were a couple of years ago. But what you have to look at again is it shows the impartiality that you're touching on there. Because if it was purely going to be WA players, we would have seen it still the majority of players there. But we haven't seen that because the talent has been there. And the talent, people that are spotting the talent and picking the players, have gone across the country to find them and brought them here. So it's not been a case of it's in WA, so it'll all be made up of WA players. It has been fair.
And just quietly, to those people who have been agitating under the comments that I've made on Facebook about this particular nines competition. They've taken it as an excuse to start teeing off about this and, oh, we've got to have it moved to these places and rah, rah, rah. The argument that, because that's where the crowds are. Oh, yeah, we'll make more money, more people will come on. That's complete and utter rubbish. Did you see the crowd figures for the Oceania Cup? You see how many people were sitting around watching that game? Did you see the Festival of Hockey in Victoria? Wow, what a crowd turnout that was. So all of those arguments are just total rubbish. We get better crowds here in Perth for international hockey than they do on the eastern states.
I still think Mark Knowles is onto the right thing, that the hockey should be played in the country areas. If you look, the majority of the players in the sport come from the country areas. You go to the country areas and they support it, and you're not having to compete with the other mainstream sports that get all the media attention. And if you take the best players in the world, and let's not forget, Australia are number one in the world, and you're taking those to country areas, that will have an impact on all the kids in those areas, and you can then get the next generation coming through. Most sports just pay lip service to the country areas. They don't actually go in there and give a damn about it, to be honest. And I just think hockey is missing a trick if it doesn't do that. And Mark Knowles, who's someone I really respect, when he said that, I sat there and thought about it and thought, you know what? You're right.
And just quietly to all the Australian sports journalists out there that think, oh, soccer's wonderful, and look at the efforts of this team and that team. You do realise that Australia has been number one, in the top four for hockey in men's for 40 years now?
Yeah, since the 1970s.
Top four in the world, never outside it. Take that, soccer, smoke that pipe. By the way, we've won World Cups, both men and women, and Olympic gold medals. Okay. That's an overage Olympic competition as well, by the way, not an under-23 joke competition.
Hopefully they'll win one this year. Now, before we go, John, just one last question for you, because it's something I've got a bee in my bonnet about at the moment. We're getting a lot of people in the media referring to players as youngsters when they're 25 years old. Now, I'm sorry, to me, a youngster is a player that breaks into the team at least before he's 21. I think after 21, sorry, you're not a youngster anymore, because usually you've been around the team or the circuit for a while, and so you may not be an established player, but you're not a youngster. A youngster is 17, 18, 19, maybe 20, but 21, let's drop the youngster when they hit 21.
Well, we was talking specifically, you mentioned a player, Joel Parris, the West Australian bowler. What I find interesting is Joel's been in that system four or five, six years.
Well,
he's
not a
youngster.
We interviewed him on Not the Footy Show, and we've been off air for over 2 years. So that tells
3 years we've been off air.
Well, there you go.
Over 3 years.
And we interviewed him when we were on air, because I remember doing it, because I actually played with his dad.
He may have been injured. He may not have played a lot of cricket, but he's not a youngster.
Not at 25.
No. And you see that a lot, don't you?
Too much.
Well,
I suppose I can start calling myself, what could I call myself? Middle-aged?
Old? No, just old, mate. Just go old.
All right, I'll stick with old.
See ya. We'll be back next week.